Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues across our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by Monitor reporters Delger Irdensana, Sean Scott, and Matt Junker. Delger, let's start with you. Tell listeners a little bit about your background and how you're planning to approach this beat.
Sure thing. So I've always covered climate and environment issues. I started my journalism career at Inside Climate News. And yeah, I mean, that's just because I think it's so important for people to like understand, you know, the planet we live on and how the ways it's changing, especially now, shapes all of our daily lives now, you know, and shapes our futures. And I actually studied earth science in college here in Maine at Bowdoin. And from there, I worked in environmental policy for a while, but got sort of a little impatient with that world and decided to become a journalist instead. So I went and got a master's degree in science reporting. And since then, I've worked in Texas, New York, back in DC, at small and big newsrooms. And I've also freelanced a bit. And I've covered things like, you know, like the science of climate change and extreme weather, chemical pollution, you know, also things like fisheries and other industries that are very much being affected by climate change and pollution and other environmental issues. And at the Monitor, I mean, I'm hoping to cover the environment pretty broadly, you know, whether that's the forests of Maine or the ocean and the coastline, you know, or, you know, energy and pollution issues. Especially, you know, in the places that people live, and kind of just be writing stories, I think, about what's most like urgent or relevant at any given moment. I really want to help people understand that the environment is not, you know, something that's like outside of our homes and places. It's actually where we live every day and, you know, where we get the resources to live our lives.
Yeah, I think of all the beats we have, it is probably sort of in some ways the most broad because, right, it just sort of touches everything that we do. So you have published two stories with us so far, and the first is about the forecast for electricity demand in the region over the next decade. This is a forecast from ISO New England, which maybe you can talk to people a little bit about what ISO New England is. I'm sure not everyone is familiar. So yeah, I think maybe actually that's where we should start. Can you just go over what ISO New England does? What is their role in the grid?
Yeah, so they describe themselves as kind of like being the air traffic controller for like the flow of electricity across the region's grid. You know, most of New England shares a grid. Most of Maine is on it. A little part of northern Maine is separate and actually connected to Canada instead. So they tell the electricity like where to go and when and how much. And they're separate from the utilities and the power plants, you know, and the solar and wind farms. They don't like actually own any power plants or power lines themselves. They're set up as this independent nonprofit organization. But they do oversee the wholesale electricity market, and they play this really important role of forecasting electricity demand, you know, both day to day and, you know, several years into the future, and helping utilities and policymakers plan for the future of the grid.
Yeah, so they do big regional grid planning because obviously the grid is not something that really obeys state lines. Like we have a Maine Public Utilities Commission, right? And they handle regulating the utility companies, so the transmission and distribution in Maine. But then ISO New England is playing that bigger regional role, right? So the ISO New England forecast that they do periodically predicted a 9% increase in electricity use over the next 10 years. Give us a little bit of context. Is that like a lot? Is it a little? How does it compare to previous forecasts?
Sort of like modest growth. You know, it is something that the grid should be able to handle, but it's significant because it's a real change in direction. For the past like 20 years or so, electricity demand has actually been falling, you know, both in Maine and in New England and just across the country generally, thanks to energy efficiency. Like we have more efficient appliances, lights, things like that. But in recent years, you know, that has started to plateau, and demand is actually expected to pick up again and grow again sometime during this next decade. And this forecast, it's actually been higher for in recent years. For example, last year, ISO New England forecast that, you know, maybe the grid would grow 11% over the next decade. But the government policy environment, especially at the federal level, has really changed, you know, with the change in administrations. And so that's why it's kind of going up and down.
Okay. And what's driving the growth over the next decade?
Yeah, I mean, because of climate change, there's been this push to use less fossil fuels, use less oil and gas, like directly for things like heating and transportation, and use more electricity instead because electricity can be generated from cleaner renewable sources like wind and solar. And so this growth is really driven by people buying electric cars, and even more so than that, people buying heat pumps and using those instead of like oil and gas heaters to heat their homes and businesses.
Yeah. So we're really kind of like electrifying things at all levels. I think the term that people might be familiar with is beneficial electrification, which is a little bit of a mouthful. But yeah, we're like electrifying all these different things in our homes, and so that is driving up the demand for this across the state. Everybody, I think mostly everybody gets a utility bill at their house that they have to pay. And the Monitor has reported that electricity rates in Maine have risen at the third highest rate in the country in recent years. They have gone up pretty significantly. It's likely that we're probably going to need more investment to accommodate all of this beneficial electrification. So, what did your reporting find on how that will impact utility bills?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends on like how this electrification is done. You know, people's utilities don't necessarily need to rise, or at least not rise like super steeply. So I mean, there's two parts to our power bills, right? The first part is generation, like where the electricity comes from. And yeah, the cost depends a lot on where it comes from. So like building new wind or solar farms, for example, is actually cheaper now, in most cases than building new coal or even natural gas power plants. And then the other part of the bill is, you know, delivery, the transmission and distribution costs. And in terms of that delivery, Maine's grid does have some extra capacity to accommodate this increased demand, you know, because our electricity demand used to be higher in the past. We have that infrastructure still, you know, but equipment does age, and we always need to maintain and eventually upgrade and replace and optimize things. And yeah, those costs just depend on how and when the utilities, I think, make those investments. And the Public Utilities Commission in Maine, they have actually recently asked Central Maine Power and Versant to submit these things called integrated grid plans, you know, for, you know, kind of laying out how they plan to do that, taking into account climate change and this push for electrification, and actually using ISO New England's forecasts. And so those plans that they submitted are under review right now at the Public Utilities Commission. And the public can take a look at them as well.
So let's shift a little bit and talk about the story that is out today. So we're talking on Friday, May 29th. It's about the Juniper Ridge landfill, which is currently the state's primary destination for sewage sludge, the biosolids that are strained out of wastewater. So about 90% of the state's sludge goes to Juniper Ridge, but that's actually a relatively new development, right? So what used to happen to sewage sludge in Maine?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it used to be just spread on farmland as fertilizer. And, you know, people thought that that was like a beneficial use. But recently, maybe in the past 10 years or so, people have really become aware of this type of pollution called PFAS, these per and polyfluoroalkyl substances is what this stands for. They're also called forever chemicals because they have these bonds that are just really hard to break down. So they persist in the environment and like in people and wildlife's bodies for a long time, and they can have, health impacts. Some of them have been associated with like certain types of cancer, for example. And so over the past several years, it's come to light that our wastewater and the sewage sludge that's strained out of it has a lot of PFAS in it. And I mean, that's just because these chemicals are like totally ubiquitous in all these everyday products that we use. So they just kind of shed off of the products we're using into our water. And they are also like in the environment, especially around things like military bases and airports, because they've been used in firefighting foam for years and years.
In the old house that we used to live in, we actually got compost one time that was sludge, and we just did, I
Oh,
mean,
wow.
it was sludge derived, and this was long, years ago before we knew, and we put it in the lawn because we were like, I don't know, I mean, we had no idea that this was a problem, we did tell the people when we sold the house that that's what we did, but yeah, I think like a lot of people did that. We just didn't know it was sold as compost, and we needed fill for the lawn, and so that's what we did. I regret it now, but yeah.
People didn't know. But now that they do, there was actually this legislation, Maine, a few years ago, became the first state to ban this, what they call land application of sludge. And so that's why now we have this problem of where to put it.
Right. And so that, so right, you mentioned this legislation that passed a few years ago that did ban the spreading of sludge, but we still have sludge. It has to go somewhere. So it has gone to the landfill, right? And what impact that did that have on Juniper Ridge specifically?
Yeah, so I mean, Juniper Ridge, they now take about 90% of all of the sewage sludge that like, piles up at the end of the day, every day at municipal wastewater treatment plants all across the state. And it's not like, it's not all or even most of the waste that the landfill is taking, but the state says it has a significant impact on their capacity. But the landfill's capacity, it was always gonna fill up anyway in the next few years, and this has just sped it up a little bit.
Yeah, I was astonished that it was 90%. That seems like a lot, that all of this sludge from all around the state is going to Juniper Ridge. And I think your story mentions that, a few years ago, it was in 2022, that there was a little bit of a crisis because they said like it was basically making the landfill unstable, and they had to stop taking it for a little bit before, while they figured out what to do, and that created its own problems, and I think like really made people realize we've got to figure out a different solution for this. So you mentioned that Juniper Ridge is filling up and has been filling up. Your story notes that as if we continue on the path that we're on right now, that Juniper Ridge will be at capacity for all kinds of waste in just 2 years, in 2028. So tell us a little about what they want to do to expand it.
Yeah, they want to expand it by about 60 acres, kind of like half as big again as it is now. So, yeah, a pretty big expansion. And if we sort of keep sending waste to it at the same rate as we are now, that would buy another decade, basically, of landfill capacity. And so this expansion plan, it has to go through a review at the Maine Department of Environmental Protection, and it's under review right now. But yeah, but there has been concerns about it, and a couple, and the Penobscot Nation and the Conservation Law Foundation, they've actually appealed this first step towards approving the expansion, called a public benefit determination.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. So, what are some of the concerns that they have raised?
Yeah, I mean, so landfills, they're a little bit leaky, unfortunately, like air and water pollution comes from landfills, and so they do have an impact on the communities that live around the landfill and on the environment, in this case, the Penobscot River. And yeah, I think especially when it comes to these PFAS, these forever chemicals, the biggest concern is this thing called leachate. So like, when it rains or snows, that water goes through the landfill and it picks up some of what's in there, and it turns into this polluted liquid called leachate. And Juniper Ridge, they ship it over to the wastewater treatment plant at the former Nine Dragons Mill in Old Town. And they treat that leachate for all sorts of things, but not for PFAS, because, that is something that we've really just started to learn about. And yeah, there's just not a lot of treatment available for it yet. And so that wastewater is then being put into the Penobscot River with all of the PFAS still in it.
Okay. And the state has asked Casella to put in a leachate treatment system as part of this expansion, correct?
They have, yeah. But I think some people, especially the Penobscot Nation, who they live really close by, and the river plays this really central role in their culture and their way of life. They're just concerned that, like, they're what the state is asking Casella, who's the landfill operator, to do in terms of treatment is just kind of maybe a little bit vague. They're not really specifying what exactly they need to do in terms of treatment options, and so they really want to be able to know more about what treatment options they're going to choose, how it's all going to work, and just, I think, have a little more time and study into, like, what even are the impacts of this PFAS pollution on the river and on wildlife and things like that.
Yeah. And in the meantime, too, we've also got plans for a new sledge drying facility in Norridgewock. So tell us a little bit about what that is and how it might help tackle some of this issue.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is another way to deal with the sludge, basically by like spreading it out, in a controlled way and just drying it. So like the volume is going to be much less. And the idea is, this new drying facility at the Crossroads landfill, which is owned and operated by Waste Management, the company. It should, once it's up and running, and it's supposed to open this year, have capacity to handle maybe 80% of the sewage sludge that's coming from our wastewater treatment plants. And it would dry it out, and so there would just be much less space-wise, and they would be able to keep it there at the landfill.
Okay. So there's a lot of moving pieces in this, it sounds like. Well, I'm sure you will have lots more to report on. But yeah, thank you so much for walking us through those two pieces. And we're so happy to have you back in Maine.
Yeah, I'm happy to be back. Thanks, Kate.
Thanks. Well, we need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, I'm joined by Monitor reporters Delger Irtenasana, Sean Scott, and Matt Yunker. All right, Sean, let's turn to you. So you've been doing some fascinating reporting lately on the growing influence of a network of Calvary Chapel churches in Maine. Maybe you can actually just start by telling us how you became interested in this particular church and why you decided to report on it.
Yeah, so Calvary Chapel has been on my radar for a little while. 6 or 8 months ago, I was reporting after Charlie Kirk's assassination on the way that that was influencing evangelical churches in Maine. And during that reporting, I went to a memorial for him that was hosted by Calvary Chapel, Greater Portland. So that was kind of my introduction to the church and to their pastor, Travis Carey. I believe that was in October. And then since that point, the church has just kept coming up as I've been digging into the way that churches are playing a role in politics. They have been involved in different lawsuits. There's one pending in front of the Maine Supreme Court right now where a mother, the court ruled that this mother could not take her daughter to Calvary Chapel services. The church was involved in petitions for restricting recreational marijuana that didn't ultimately make the ballot this year. And they've also been involved in efforts to kind of increase the actual presence of evangelical people in the state house through weekly worship services. So they just kept getting onto my radar. And then as they were kind of building their own profile, it felt like a good lens to me to kind of look at how broader conversations about Christian conservatism are playing a role in Maine.
Yeah, it's really I read the story with so much fascination because I hadn't heard of this network of churches before. It was new to me. And you spent a lot of time for this story at Calvary Chapel, Greater Portland. Tell us, and you brought a photographer with you, which was wonderful. I took some really beautiful photos of the congregants. So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, so I have visited the church several times, once for their actual service. They are in Westbrook, even though they're the Greater Portland church, and they are very active. I think that's the biggest thing that I've noticed as I've reported on them. So they have Sunday morning services, Sunday evening services, Wednesday services, and all of those services are different from each other. And then they have different ministries or events basically every day of the week. I believe maybe Saturdays they don't have anything going on. They have their coffee shop downstairs. They have a lot of like children's areas. So it's just a very kind of, there's a lot going on all the time at this church, and it's in a former kind of office building. The services themselves, they always start with worship music for maybe half an hour or so. It was interesting to me. People kind of meander in while that's happening. Like the service starts, but there are still people outside or at the coffee shop, and then they kind of work their way inside during the music. And then there's about an hour sermon that happens. And their kind of big model that distinguishes them from other churches is that they go verse by verse. So over the course of about 10 years, they read the Bible cover to cover with maybe 5 or 10 verses per service and just extremely deep dive into those verses. I believe Greater Portland launched 6 years ago, and they are maybe like halfway through. So, yeah, it was a really interesting experience.
Wow, so if you start with a congregation like this year, you would come in midway through the reading of the Bible?
Yeah. And I don't think that, like, they do build on one another. So, there is some level of back referencing that's helpful, but they do also all of their sermons, and this was very helpful to me. They live stream them on YouTube and then they stay up in perpetuity after that.
Oh, so you can go back if you kind of missed the first part of it, so to speak. Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that that was the structure. Is that unique, do you know, to Calvary Chapel?
I don't know if it's unique or not. I know that other evangelical denominations like the Southern Baptists do not do verse by verse. So I think it is distinguishing, but maybe not exclusive.
Well, another thing that sets them apart from certainly some churches that folks might be aware of is that it is a fairly explicitly political congregation. What did you hear? And you touched a little bit on this in your opening, but what did you hear from the pastor and the congregants about why they feel the need to be involved in politics?
Yeah, so they touch on a lot of different elements of politics. in each service. And it's not something that necessarily comes up in every service, but if you go to enough, they will talk about gender and sexuality or immigration or Israel comes up a fair amount, especially at Calvary Chapel Bangor. But more so than any specific issue, they talk a lot about the separation of church and state itself. And Travis Carey, who's the pastor of Calvary Chapel Greater Portland, he described that to me as a misnomer, where he does not believe that there should be this delineated separation, or that the separation of church and state should be state not influencing church and not the other way around. He described it to me and to his congregation repeatedly as kind of a dereliction of duty to not be engaged in politics. They see their role as, well, first off, they frame all of these political issues as moral issues, and their justification for involvement is, of course, the church is involved in morality, so they see it as kind of a duty or a responsibility to be involved. And after they reframe it that way, they kind of describe their role as influencing culture. And so you'll see them push for specific policies or specific issues, like they gathered signatures for the transgender ballot referendum this year. But more than the specific issues, my impression was this focus of government as God ordained, and that they have a responsibility to be involved in it.
Well, yeah, so to tell us, you just touched on another one and you talked a little bit about this at the top, but what are some of the ways that the church has gotten involved in politics in recent years?
Yeah, so I started back in 2020 for this story during the COVID-19 pandemic. That was an extremely public foray into politics for Calvary Chapel Bangor in particular. Their pastor, Ken Graves, held services that went against the pandemic era policies on restricting gathering sizes. And that lawsuit, they eventually ended up appealing to the Supreme Court, which declined to step in, but the fact that it got to that level is noteworthy. They've had a couple lawsuits since then, or different Calvary chapels within Maine have had a couple lawsuits since then. I mentioned the daughter who judge ruled that the mother could not bring this daughter to the church because it was causing harm. And that's pending before the Maine Supreme Court right now. Aside from the court cases, Calvary Chapel Greater Portland in particular hosted, I believe, every Republican gubernatorial candidate during Sunday services over the past few months, like literally ceded the floor for them to talk for 5 minutes about their platform and to talk to attendees after the service. They've had several local candidates as well, a couple local candidates who are members of the church running for higher office. Also, I think I mentioned they gather signatures both for the transgender ballot initiative, and they were pretty involved in getting the recreational marijuana restrictions that did not ultimately make it to the ballot. They were involved in that process. And then since Charlie Kirk died, a lot of the Calvary chapels in Maine have become hosts to Turning Point Faith chapters, which are under the umbrella of Turning Point USA, but they look through a specifically Christian lens. And they may hold monthly events or politicians to speak to the congregations. Maine actually has more Turning Point Faith chapters than any other New England state, in large part because of the number of Calvary chapels that we have here. And then a few weeks ago, obviously, that led to their large event, part of the Make Heaven Crowded tour for Turning Point Faith, which attracted a lot of controversy. And the church itself would describe that event as non-political, but it was happening in this political context of this is framing a revival through an explicitly conservative organization.
Yeah, I mean, I think it may be that a lot of people have just heard of this church because of their role in bringing the Turning Point event at the Portland Expo, as you mentioned. And I think you threaded it through this story as well. You the impact Charlie Kirk's death really impacted the people in this congregation. What did you How did his death impact the people that you spoke to? What did they tell you?
I think it was surprising to me in talking to the pastors and congregants how personal his death felt to a lot of them. And for some of them, it was genuinely personal. I mentioned Ken Graves, who's the pastor at Calvary Bangor, and he's the one who's helped plant so many of these churches in Maine. Most of them are offshoots of Calvary Bangor. And he had met Charlie Kirk before the pandemic, and then during the pandemic was in this group chat with him and other pastors to the way that he describes it as fighting against COVID tyranny. So all of these pastors who were holding services in opposition to state level restrictions. So he had this ongoing rapport with Charlie Kirk starting around 2020. In 2021, Charlie Kirk actually spoke to the Bangor congregation and they stayed in touch through his death in 2025. So for him, it actually was personal. This is someone that he knew fairly well. But they also kind of described it as bringing more people into the church because he was so explicit in advocating for policy from a conservative Christian perspective. And so they say that it's brought more people into the Calvary Chapels more broadly, especially because they are so vocal about politics. And then a couple pastors that I talked to who started new churches in around November said they had been planning to start churches for some time, but after his assassination, they kind of fast-tracked those processes because they wanted to be more in the community and reach more people with their specific flavor of Christianity.
That was fascinating. I was surprised at how personal, like you said, how personal his death felt to many people that you spoke to. Unfortunately, you weren't actually able to attend the Turning Point USA event in Portland because our press credentials were denied, which was unfortunate. But you did go and you stood outside and you spoke to a few people. What did you hear about why they were there?
I spoke to a few people, a couple from Westbrook and a couple from Bangor who made the trip down to Portland for it. They all framed it similarly to how the pastors were framing the event in advance, where they described it as kind of bringing God back to Maine. And the context for that framing is Maine is one of the least religious states in the country. And there is an evangelical research firm which had put out a study in the past couple of years describing Portland specifically as they used the word unchurched, one of the most unchurched cities in the country. So they really saw this event as a faith-based outreach, trying to reach people who are maybe not members of the congregation. All of the people that I spoke to were members of Calvary Chapel itself, but they really pushed back on describing it as political, even though it was in this context. And policy-wise, the church is very much aligned with the Republican Party on most issues, if not all issues. And I will say, after the event, I believe they said they had almost 40 people. The way that the organizers described it was almost 40 people dedicating themselves to Christ at the event. I don't have much more detail on that because I was not able to be there. Separate from that, though, I was able to go to a counter event down the street at the Unitarian Universalist Church. They had an event called Love is the Point, and they had about 350 people or so there. The organizers of that event view Turning Point as pretty like aligned with white Christian nationalism. So they saw their event as a kind of a counterpoint to that. And it was pretty interesting. They were very focused on immigrants' rights and trans rights. They talked a little bit about homelessness as well. Lots of singing involved. It was very kind of the energy to me was very love thy neighbor was their scriptural focus of it, even though they came from a number of different congregations. I think they had a little over 20 organizations overall represented there.
Did you speak to anybody at Calvary Chapel about sort of this allegation, I guess I would call it, that it is a white Christian nationalist, that is sort of the policy bent?
I don't think we explicitly talked about white Christian nationalism. I have talked about white Christian nationalism with organizations they're aligned with, like the Christian Civic League, and a couple other pastors in the States. And what I've heard from them is that it feels like a fear tactic or a they don't feel that the label is accurate, but these are churches who see the founding of the US as explicitly Christian, or that the US is an explicitly Christian nation, and that it should be a Christian nation, Judeo-Christian, influenced by scripture or the Bible in some way, or that it's God ordained. And to that extent, to the extent that you define Christian nationalism as a belief in the country founded as a Christian nation, I do not think that they would shy away from that. But they would probably argue that it's not a bad term, I guess.
Yeah, I see that it doesn't have the same negative connotation that the folks you spoke to at the other event might put on it. Well, thank you so much, Sean. That was fascinating. We need to take another quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, I'm joined by Monitor reporters Delger Irdensana, Sean Scott, and Matt Yunker. The Main Monitor Radio Hour is a production of the Main Monitor, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. You can read all of our work at themainmonitor.org. All right, so Matt, we're going to talk to you. We're going to totally switch gears here and talk about elections. You recently published two stories on a referendum that was slated to appear on the ballot in November. And listeners may have heard about this referendum question, which would have required that public schools restrict access to bathrooms and sports based on the gender on a child's birth certificate, original birth certificate, I should say. I think it might actually be helpful to start with some basics on the citizen-led referendum process in Maine, which I did not realize, but I learned from your story, has been around for more than 100 years. And I think anybody who lives in Maine will know, we've seen some really big changes via this process in re recent decades. This is, we've seen gay people gain the right to marry, recreational marijuana become legal, ranked choice voting. So, I'm going to start with a super basic question. How do you get a citizen initiative on the ballot?
Well, it's a basic question, but maybe not the most basic answer. But so it's a pre-prescribed process, both in the Constitution and state law. But basically, how it starts with a very small handful of Maine voters. You basically need one Maine voter to come forward with an idea for citizen-initiated legislation, and they need to submit the proposed text of that legislation, a summary of it, and they need five other signatures from Mainers. And they submit that, those six people is how it starts, submit an initial application to the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office then reviews that, and if it's approved, then those people can start collecting signatures statewide. And that's when you get to the position we have been in recent months, where you have people going around the state collecting signatures, and trying to get that initiative on the ballot. And what they need, it's only six signatures to get that initial application, but it's a much higher number in order to actually get on the ballot. You know, by design, this process is not supposed to be easy. You know, it's supposed to be bring issues to the forefront that lots of Maine people want to weigh in on, so that it's not, you're not having, you know, 100 referendums on 100 different, you know, on a million different issues all the time. And so you, it's a fairly high threshold of signatures to get on the ballot. It's 10% of the number of votes in the previous election for governor. So it's a little kind of bureaucratic, but basically what that means in layman's terms right now is around slightly under 70,000 signatures are required to get an initiative on the ballot. So that's the biggest hurdle and threshold that you have to meet. And if somebody, once you submit those signatures to the Secretary of State's office, the Secretary of State reviews those signatures. If they're found valid, then the legislature has a chance to weigh in on the proposed legislation. They can either adopt it as is. They can recommend a competing measure, which is basically, you know, it can be something similar, either say something, you know, slightly differently than what the legislation has proposed, or maybe something counter to it. There can be, you know, multiple measures could appear on the ballot, or they could do nothing, which in that case, then the question moves on to voters. So again, kind of a complicated answer to what seems like a simple question. But that's the
Okay.
sort of general track that a and there's two forms also, I should note. There's citizen initiative, which is a piece of legislation that a Maine voter suggests. There's also a people's veto, which uses generally the same process. The timeline is a little different, but that is a piece of, again, coming from the people, but is a direct reaction to something the legislature has already done. So a people's veto is a referendum question that seeks to basically overturn an action from the legislature, while a citizen's initiative question, like what we've been discussing currently, is something proactively coming from the people that proposes a new law.
Okay. And so these are the folks that, like, if you go to vote, you see them in a little room off to the, well, in my case, like they're in a room off to the side after you leave the space where you vote, and they're collecting signatures for whatever it is
And
that
I
they're
want to be
looking at.
precise. I don't know the exact requirements. I know there are specific requirements about how far they need to be away from
Right.
everything. It might be different in different polling places, whether they're in a hallway, in a room, or that sort of thing. But generally, yes, you often see these folks. I think a election day and things like that are target-rich environments, for lack of a better word, for petition gathering, because the people who can sign these petitions need to be Maine voters. And so you know that people who are going to the polls are voters by definition. These people
Right.
are going to vote. So, you know, there's not a heavy question of are these people from Maine and are they voters? Because if they're there
Right.
voting, they almost surely are.
Right. So let's actually talk about that, because it's a big part of the story that you just published. So who can sign a petition and who can collect signatures?
So the first question is a lot simpler than the second one. The who can sign petitions is any registered Maine voter can sign a petition. And what they basically have to do is there are these petition forms, and you fill out your you have to include your name, your address, your municipality where you're a voter, and sign. And actually, an interesting nuance of this is the circulator can fill out some of the information for the voter. So they actually could fill out things like their name, their address, and their town. But the signature, crucially, has to come from the person, from the voter, not from the person circulating the petition. And again, that can be any Maine voter can sign these petitions. Now,
Okay.
who collects the signatures, we could spend an hour talking about. It's a kind of nuanced, complicated process right now, but the simplest form is pretty much anybody can circulate those, whether they are a Maine resident or someone from outside of the state of Maine. That hasn't always been the case. Historically, it's been limited just to Maine voters have been the ones who can circulate these petitions. But in recent years, there's been a change, and we can get into it a little bit more later. But there's been a recent change that has opened the door to out-of-state circulators as well, as long as they agree to submit to the legal jurisdiction of Maine. But how we got to that point is itself a very complicated legal maze.
Yeah, that was fascinating to me that I guess I just assumed, I'd never thought about it too hard, but I guess I just assumed that like if you're going to collect signatures for a petition, you're going to be a voter in Maine. But yes, that is not actually the case. So we will get to that. Maybe we'll get to it sort of a little bit right now. What requirements are there for signature gathering?
So there's a host of them, and they've come to the forefront in this current referendum question. I think, you know, the sort of the top line things for these signature gathers, and I'm this isn't going to be an exhaustive list, I'm sure. Please don't consider this to be every single one, but there are things like the circulators have to make the summary of the initiative available to voters as they're signing. They have to be able to look at a summary of what this, the official summary of what this would actually do. And they also have to include a fiscal impact statement that's been developed, I believe, in concert between the Secretary of State and the Office of Fiscal Management. I'm not 100% on who all is involved in that, but it's basically an official state determination projection of what an initiative like this would cost taxpayers. So those th that documentation has to be made available to people as they're signing these things. That's in statute as a requirement that circulators must provide that information. Circulators, the people gathering these signatures, also have to be present for all of the signatures that are made on the forms that they submit. That's proven to be a key piece here as well. That's come up in the current case. That's working its way through the review process now, is whether all circulators, you know, were present and observed all of the signatures that were made on their forms. So that's a key requirement as well. Also, all
Well,
of the
so
circulators
yeah.
also have to pledge and make an oath saying that they have followed the rules. And if they don't, there's a list of various class E crimes that circulators could be, you know, potentially at risk of if they attest to that oath but haven't done all the things within that oath. So that's sort of some of the legal enforcement that exists in this process.
Yeah, so basically, like you can't just circulate one of these petitions online, right? You have to be present and see the person signing it.
Yes.
Okay.
And there may be some legal flexibility in terms of what counts as seeing. You know, do you need to see the person? Do you need to see the actual signature marked on the paper versus do you just visibly see them signing? You know, that level of nuance, I don't have an exact answer for. But yes, this is not something that you can't circulate these virtually. You know, there is language in statute that requires your presence as the signatures. Any signature that an individual petitioner submits, they need to have been present for. And
Okay.
that's come to the forefront of this current debate.
Yeah, so let's talk about this. So this referendum question that you wrote about, we've got two separate stories that you wrote for it this week. It initially made it onto the ballot, right? Then what happened?
And so I'll just preface that by saying it still might be. We're still sort of in the middle of what's now probably going to be a judicial review. And so there's been some talk about this as in it's definitively not going to be on the ballot. And I just think it's too soon for us to know. And so basically, what happened was the Secretary of State did an initial review process of this ballot question, the Protect Girl Sports in Maine initiative. And in March, Secretary of State Shenna Bellows found that it had enough valid signatures, and that it was going to be on the November ballot. What happened then was through the existing review and appeals process in state statute, you had three Maine residents essentially file an appeal in court to that determination. And then the court started looking at some of the signatures, and in a pretty rare case of this process, actually remanded the review, sent it back to the Secretary of State, basically saying you need to relook at some of these signatures. There's some open question. Secretary of State's office had already at that point accepted that there were some signatures that they actually shouldn't have counted. And then in this most recent review process, they conducted a hearing, held some took some witness testimony from folks both involved in gathering the petitions and people who observed them gathering the petitions. And the Secretary of State determined that actually more of those signatures should be invalidated. And that actually took the margin of approved signatures from being above that threshold, around 70,000, to about 500 signatures under the threshold. And so this week on Tuesday, Secretary of State Bellows actually issued an updated determination based off of a recommendation from her staff that there were not enough valid petitions, and therefore this initiative is invalid for the November election. Again, now this is going to go back to the courts. The courts are going to review some of the same arguments, maybe some slightly different legal arguments, and I think you're going to see some additional wrangling on over that final number. And given that we're only about 500 away from that approval threshold, I don't think it's certain where this is going to end up. It would be very interesting to see if the court agrees with all of the signatures that have been invalidated, because there are some pretty complex legal and constitutional arguments at play here. And it might be a good that might be a good way for us to talk more about the out of state petition gatherer question, because that really gets to this issue.
Yeah, this, I mean, the story, one of the stories opens with testimony from this guy, man from Georgia, who called into a hearing at the Maine State House earlier this month. And he wasn't in Georgia at all. He was like on a boat in the, where was he on a boat?
He was
Pacific?
somewhere in the Pacific Ocean.
Somewhere in the Pacific.
It wasn't quite clear from his testimony, and it was actually like kind of a very logistically fascinating process to even get him on the line. They had to extend the hearing by a whole day just to be able to find, basically get a connection that worked in order to talk to him.
Wow. Okay, so he's like on a boat in the Pacific Ocean. He's from Georgia and he's not a Maine resident. And he said that he had been collecting signatures to get this transgender referendum question on the ballot in Maine. So right, like we talked a little bit about this. Is that legal? Can people from out of state sign petitions to get the
Yes,
referendum?
it hasn't always been the case.
Yeah.
And actually, if you were to go and look at the Maine state constitution right now, you would see language that basically says that you have to be a Maine voter to collect these to circulate these petitions and gather signatures. However, a couple years ago, there was a lawsuit over this issue. There was a different ballot question. The organization wanted to use outside petition gatherers to help them collect signatures. But state law and state constitution said you couldn't, that you have to be a Maine resident. And they actually sued over that. And a federal judge here in Maine issued at least a preliminary ruling. It wasn't a final ruling, but it was enough to basically say, yeah, it seems like Maine's requirement that you be a Maine voter to collect these signatures actually violates the First Amendment of the US Constitution. That basically people outside of the state have a First Amendment right to come here and engage politically in this way. And I'm probably there are more legal arguments at play. That's my non-legal summary. But basically, the judge was saying Maine's prohibition on out-of-state circulators probably violates the First Amendment, and would probably be struck down in court. And so what happened was the state and this previous ballot initiative came into what's known as a consent agreement, that basically rendered the provisions of the state constitution and state statute essentially unenforceable. So that is a very complicated, convoluted way of saying, even though we technically have this provision on the books, saying you have to be a Maine voter to collect these signatures, out of state people can. The state has developed under the framework of this consent agreement, a framework where out of state people can come to Maine and circulate these petitions and gather signatures. But there's a form on that circulator's oath form that they sign saying that they followed the rules, they also check a residency box, and they either say that they're from Maine or they're not from Maine, and they agree to submit to the jurisdiction of Maine. And so that is a very long way of saying this man from Georgia was not doing anything wrong by coming from out of state and circulating petitions. That's not the question here with these invalidated signatures. The question is about whether, and we're really we are talk we are the challenge focuses on the out of state petition gatherers, but it's not the fact that they're out of state. It's whether they then followed the rules of that Maine has for this process, signed the appropriate forms, did the things they needed to do. And some of that is related to them being out of state, but it's not because they're from out of state, if that makes sense. It's not on its face, it's not illegal or wrong to come from out of state now and circulate these petitions in Maine. But it's very complicated because if you looked at Maine
It's
law or the
deeply,
Constitution, you would see language that says you have to be from Maine.
Right.
But
That's
there's
deeply
it's
confusing.
yeah. But it's good. It leads to a lot of really interesting constitutional arguments that I think you're going to play out in court over authorities that the state does or doesn't have to make these out of state people sign forms, check boxes. And so that I think is why we don't really know for sure what's going to happen in the court action, whether there's going to maybe be some signatures revalidated or not. But what we do know is that we have involvement of out of state circulators in a way that we haven't had previously, just because by definition, up until a couple of years ago, you had to be from in-state to be one of these circulators. And so we actually, the Maine Monitor, we requested those individual oath forms from each of the petitioners. Secretary of State provided us around 320 forms. And you can see by going through where people have provided their residency, whether they're in state or out of state. And we crunched the numbers. And of the approximately 320 people who circulated signatures for this current effort, about 120 of them were from out of state. So that's nearly 40% of the signature gatherers for this effort were not from Maine. And it's now only been a couple of years that that's even allowed. So there's nothing wrong with that number in that like nobody's doing anything wrong by coming from out of state again. But it is very interesting that we've gone from just a few years ago, that number had to be zero. And now we're at 40% for this effort.
It is going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out. And we only have about a minute left, so I'm just going to ask you really quickly, like, what happens now?
So I don't know if there's going to be, or even if there needs to be a specific appeal initially, because this issue was previously in the Superior Court, and they remanded it back to the Secretary of State. I think the next step is it goes back to the Superior Court, and I think will rule on the Secretary's decision, either accept it and then the ballot, and then it doesn't go to the ballot in November. They could reject it and put it on the ballot, or the court could actually remand it back to the Secretary of State again if there are still unresolved issues about signature validity. And then after the Superior Court process, there's also provided specifically in state statute, either party in this case can appeal to the Maine Supreme Judicial Court. They have a 3-day window to do that after the Superior Court weighs in. It's probably ultimately going to be the courts who have the final call here, ruling on the Secretary of State's decision.
All right, you have been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio, WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill.